Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Where the Coquitlam River and the Pitt River met was where my brother did his swimming. And I was scared of water, so I never did the swimming, but he did. He took to water like a fish, and he was just excellent at it, but not me. This here's probably my back porch, my front lawn, Coquitlam River, on my apartment over there. Eventually the Pitt River comes into this here. See, the tide's coming in now. It looks like the waves are going that way. Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I just found that out. That's the tide coming in. I said, I thought rivers just went downstream. He says, no, Mom, when the tide comes up, the river's get full. So I learned that coming home, back home. I just love listening to the quiet and the bird chirping every once in a while. Beautiful, though, eh? And serene. My final years of my life, this is awesome for me, you know. I was born here. This is my country. This is where I belong. I've always belonged here. I've never doubted in my mind that I wasn't going to be back. Even things that happened in my life that prevented me from coming home when I wanted to, I knew I was coming back. And just to be here and to see what we have is freedom for me, real freedom. My full name is Doreen Beverly Glamorine Pinchbeck Maiden Murkowski, married. And I was born right here on Coquitlam Reservation.
My name is Francis Pinchbeck. I was born in Vancouver, Canada, February 3rd, 1937. I'm very proud of my mother. She was number one in my book. Very proud lady. At the age of, I think it was 6 years old, she was taken from the reservation here by some Catholic priests or nuns, and was taken to a convent north of Vancouver, Canada, where she spent 8 years learning the language, of the English language. And for 8 years, she never learned any Indian language at all. So after 8 years of schooling, she left there, came home, not knowing anything about the Indian language. This is the group of students. Probably 90% of them are all Indians. I don't know how they were taken from their homes. But my mother is located right here. I had an uncle. Everybody was so proud of. His name was Oliver Jasper Dan. We all called him, nicknamed him Boise. And this is a very handsome looking uncle of mine. And he also went to that convent in north of Vancouver. he was taken away from home here to go up there also.
My mommy told me, but we must have been living in Vancouver, and she was pregnant, I think, with Francis, my older brother. And she craved apples. So every time she'd go by one of these here markets that had the fruit on the outside, she'd grab an apple and take off running like mad. But she told us, never steal. That wasn't stealing, she was hungry.
I was born in Vancouver, Canada, February 3rd, 1937. Behind my grandmother's home, there was a church. The church was very well built. There was probably 30 lanes of people where we could sit, and we used to always go in there and play hide and seek. The nuns had given the church up and had gone back to better things, I guess. I guess there wasn't enough money here, because we never had any money. We used to go there and play hide and seek. My sister, Irene Point, myself, and O.J. Boise. We'd play hide and seek and hide between the aisles and stuff. And it was awful, a lot of fun. And those were some of the fun days I remember being a youngster like that. Right down here on Colony Road, the road that you came down. If you went across, if you went right straight up that Colony Farm Road and went over that, was that Lohi Road, they call it, Lohi. If you went right across the Lohi Road, that's where the school used to be. And it was Essendale Grade School.
The school was one teacher, taught the first grade, second grade, third grade, up to eighth grade. And every row was a grade.
And it went from the first row to the eighth row.
And my brother and I was in the third grade, my sister was in the eighth grade.
And then my mother married a fellow who was a welder at Bainbridge Island. And then we moved to the States, where I resided ever since.
And that was back in 1946 when we left here. I was 8 years old. Mommy was learned to be a welder at the shipyard in Bainbridge Island. During the war, a lot of the women were going down there and my stepdad was also working there, and that's where she met him, and then they married. And that took us from here down to the States.
My mother pressured us to go to school, listen to the news, read the newspaper, so much so that I didn't want to listen to the news, not knowing how very important it was. But when I went to school in the States, I went to a high school called Peninsula High School. As you see by this picture, I'm the only person of skin color. And back in the 50s, they were a little tricky on this. But anyway, I was pretty talented in some of the sports. And for that reason, I made the baseball team. And we went undefeated for 3 straight years. And this is the picture of yours truly, right there. After I got out of high school, I commercial fished for about 2 years. Then I joined the service, the United States Army. I'm going to show you the picture when I was 1959. I'm so small, I can't even see myself. But there I am, right there. My head fits underneath most of the soldiers at the time. I've never seen so many tall men.
And when I was 18 years old, I knew I was coming back home. I knew it. And I never quite made it back because I ended up getting married and having children and raising them and working. And I started coming back and 1984, I came up here and started visiting and seeing my cousins and everything. And my son came up here first, my oldest boy, and they liked it. They'd been up here with me, so they liked Canada. So he came up and stayed and got a job and we got a place on IR2 over there. And he says, called me up and says, Mom, I've got a place, he says, for us to stay. Do you want to come up? And I says, I'll put in my 2 weeks' notice and I'll be right there. And I did that. I put in my 2 weeks' notice and, you know, here I am leaving for the rest of my life, right? I still have to do things proper and put in my 2 weeks' notice. But I did that and came up here. And I had thoughts at one time of wanting to, I thought, this isn't what I expected it to be, you know. I had relatives here, and some of the things I was hearing didn't sit well with me. And I thought, I don't need this. I was going to go back. And then I got this message from my mummy, or from somebody that knew this area real well. And they said, Beverly, this is where you belong. You've got to get in here, understand here that this is where you belong. And so I thought that over really careful, and I said, you know, I don't care what anybody says. This is where I belong. I was born here. I was born right up there, probably 150 feet from where I live now, you know. And just that fact, I said, I can't leave. This is where I belong. All my life I've wanted to come back home, you know. I'm a Canadian citizen. This is where I belong. This right here is where I belong. Back home for 5 years, May 29th. And here I am. And I'm happy. I am happy. I'm content. I'm relaxed. And anything that the band offers, I partake in because I figure it's my duty as a citizen of this nation.
If you told us 50 years ago there was going to be a street out here with homes on both sides of that street where the tribal members could stay, I would have said I doubt it. But Ron, our chief, brought in the soil. It sat for about what, a year and a half, Randy? It sat about a year and a half. You know, it had settled into the ground. Then he brought in the bulldozers and went to work, and lo and behold, there's homes out here right behind us with that main street going right down the middle. Mom and all the past people that were here at the res would have rolled over in their grave if they saw something like that.
If we go to the bridge over here, you can see where they've done a lot of their work and stuff, and eventually, I told him, I really like a Walmart in there, so I could walk over to the Walmart and come back. Eventually, it's going to be, you know, up and running, and things are going to be nicer for us. I've been away from the reserve for a long time, and I'm just now getting familiar with all the sayings and everything that we're doing as a nation, and I'm learning myself. So this is all a learning experience for me.
How is it that we can obtain more answers and more acknowledgement of who we are? So therefore stepped into searching within our archaeologists. Okay, if the answer's not coming there in a verbal sense, then the earth is going to tell us the place of which we always go back to search, the earth. And we start finding our artifacts, and they started telling us stuff. And that gave us a baseline of which to work on. And then it was just a matter of getting the appropriate things back, such as the language and our songs to come back, having our elders wear the regalia again, putting our canoe back in the river as it had been for over 100 years or so, and start building on that heritage so that it we know that we planted it here, and now it's just taking roots.
And it's really believing in our past, not knowing much about it, but hearing Fred wanting this here, really believing and that this is going to happen. The elders complex, that was the first thing Ron said he was going to do for us, and he has. And you know, there was a lot of complaints. People complained because things weren't going their way how they may have wanted it, but they put up an elders complex. And one of our elders passed already, And another elder lost her husband, and she's in there now and happy. And that's what we have to be thankful for. If it wasn't for Ron, this may have got done eventually, but I don't think it would have been that soon. That he gave us that promise and he kept it. And then after that was there and funds were available, the 8-plex went up and brought some more of our people back home that lived off the reserve. And this is their home. So we needed that structure. We needed those things. I mean, I had a place. I lived with my son off the reserve. And as soon as that opened up, boom, I was there, you know.
I've never felt so peaceful in my life as I have here. How many do we have in our language class now?
About anywhere from 9 to 12.
Yeah. And last year it was just Carl and me. The only ones that seemed to show interest. And all of a sudden, we've got more interest, you know. And that was important to me, learning some native. And I've asked for years. And Ron told me one time, we've had it here, but nobody shows up. So I'm going to be there.
That's going to be one of the real prideful things that we're going to be going on, singing our songs as it is, and presenting our names, and coming up and as we do blessings and stuff to give traditional names to our people that are coming home, meaning so much that everybody knows, like you say, knows who they are and stuff like that. To get our youth invigorated, like we're talking about getting things going, it'll be out there to captivate those youth that aren't living on the nation, to get their spirits hungry and say, I want to come home now.
There's been, you know, one or two additions since 2015, but really, like a couple of births, but like add-ins from people who are working to get their status, you know, like that list doesn't grow very fast. You know.
Yeah. I come up periodically and see some of my relatives, and of course up here they're all relatives, they're all cousins, and I've never known before.
I don't know how many others feel as fortunate as I do. I'm content. And I think that's really important. We get into our final years to be content.
This is Bird Note. Mexico's bumblebee hummingbird is one of the smallest birds in the world. Less than 3 inches in size and weighing less than a bottle cap, they're easily confused with a bumblebee as they buzz by. Because of their bright green, blue, and purple colors, bumblebee hummingbirds can also look like beetles. And that's why they're known locally as mayatito, which means bright-colored scarab in Nahuatl, the language of the Mexicas. During the breeding season, male bumblebee hummingbirds put on a show to attract females. They fly in U-shaped patterns, buzz with their wings, and show off their colorful plumage. As tiny as they are, bumblebee hummingbirds are fierce. Males defend their feeding territories vigorously, chasing off competitors and performing aggressive display flights. Perhaps that's why the ancient Mexicas associated hummingbirds with their most important god, Huitzilopochtli, the god of war, and of love. Huitzil means hummingbird in Nahuatl. Bumblebee hummingbirds are mostly found in western Mexico and parts of Central America. So if you're in the area and you feel like a bumblebee is flying by, think again before you try scaring it away. It might be the tiniest little warrior buzzing past. For Bird Note, I'm Lucina Melesio.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, this is CJSF 90.1 reminding you to stay safe. And that through Campus Community Radio, you can let CJSF 90.1 listeners know about an important community event or a public service. Email your information to cjsfpsa@sfu.ca. That was cjsfpsa@sfu.ca. Let us know the where, the when, and the how, and we can take it from there. We would love to help your community service have a wider public engagement. Remember, email cjsfpsa@sfu.ca.
The name, I'm down by the bay. I'm drinking up a bit from a $50 mug, a few cups a day. My style's from above, the funk maker making funk raise out the mud. See, I've been doing this and now producers barely catching. Up with my horse, jazz, I'm pain dispatching. When I'm in the mouth, then I'm up to much mischief. How can you lose when you cruise along to this ship? Funk so plump, plump like gin. Generation X, where my style began. On a summer eve, I might go to the hill with my vintage Wilder on the wrist. It's so like a rototiller, roto-rooted with the funk. Funky like a drain pipe filled with gunk. There's none like me, cause I catch wreck nightly. When I'm in the lab, funk I don't take lightly. Yo, no rappers rapping like they really wanna rap. My name is Kareem, I'm like Roger and Zap. Clap on to the that didn't deliver. To really get the style, then you must come hither. You know what's like this. I relish the grimy like PMD. I'm DMC. Drams really wanna freak me. Look at the color of the sky at night. Around 10 p.m., that's when I ignite. Yo, the funk through the speaker, the false creaky creaker. Ripping up a jam, then decide if it's a keeper. In the studio, I rock up in his volcano. On the west, the seas is all land. Yo, listen to Serene, cause Serene is the way. The style of the future, and from back in the day. If it ain't broke, you know it ain't no joke. I go to Cicinos with a bit and Fritos. Piece the hype and the way we roll. I got gravy soul, I rock the suede, you know. The vintage Allen Edmonds give me all the lessons. To understand Kareem, you must comprehend the essence. You know what's like this. Word up. Yeah. You know what's like this. Word up.
Patricia Hotel has occupied the corner of Dunleavy and Hastings of the Vancouver East Side for over 100 years. Its lifespan approaches that of Vancouver itself. The surrounding Strathcona neighborhood grew alongside the hotel and has supplied some of the city's richest history. A wealth of culture moved along those streets and through the corridors of the hotel. People's lives pulsed through the building's arteries and spilled out into the world. The building has weathered the Vancouver rains and the neighborhood's mounting social struggles. It continues to provide affordable lodging to travelers in one of the world's least affordable cities, and supports local performers who would otherwise go unnoticed. The story of the hotel begins where the story of old Vancouver ends, because new Vancouver could only rise after old Vancouver burned. James Johnston is an East Vancouver House researcher and historian.
On June 13, 1886, there was a big wind that came up and a stump fire spread to some other debris, and the wind was going in the right direction, or the wrong direction, I guess, for the city of Vancouver. And in 40 minutes, the new city of Vancouver basically exploded. They said that Vancouver didn't actually burn down, it actually exploded and was consumed in 40 minutes.
Lonnie Resworm is an East Vancouver resident and local historian.
When the fire came, it pretty much cleared out all these rickety, you know, shacks that were thrown up. And so when they rebuilt, which the rebuilding started right away, and it was sort of gave them a clean slate to build what the developers assumed would be like this major West Coast metropolis.
Construction on what would become the Patricia Hotel began in 1910. Originally intended as a doctor's office, the founder of the building, Dr. Thomas Wilson, would not survive to see its completion. The property was acquired by Edward Mulhern, who converted the space into a hotel and opened for business in the summer of 1913. The city had become the modern metropolis predicted by the developers. The railway was bringing in new residents, and the historic Hastings Mill, located a few minutes' walk from the Patricia Hotel, was supplying work to loggers from all over the world.
There's an ad from a 1913 News Herald that talks about it being a new popular-priced hotel, and that they advertised it as being two blocks from City Hall. Perhaps that was a draw. It was trying to say that it was really in the center of the happening part of Vancouver.
The typical tenant would be a logger who works out in logging camps most of the year, and then he makes a bunch of money and he comes to Vancouver to spend the winter and blow this wad of cash in his pocket on booze and women and whatever else he's into.
They were out to sow their wild oats, to have fun, to maybe have a little bit of a dust up with whoever, but it was to get rid of all the stress, the accumulated stress of living in very, very primitive, cold conditions out in the wild. And so it would have been a rather interesting mix of customers in the Patricia Hotel at that time.
By 1917, Hastings Street had become a swinging entertainment district. The Patricia Hotel opened a cabaret under the title Patricia Cafe, later renamed Pat's Pub. Ada Bricktop Smith, the nightclub queen of Europe, was singing, dancing, and dodging loggers at the hotel before her move to Paris. In her memoirs, Bricktop by Bricktop, she recounts a particularly rowdy New Year's Eve at the cafe.
No one knows what the fight was all about. Everybody was beating up on everybody else. Bowman's was a large place. I remember all the fists flying and glass breaking, but that's all I remember. It was one of those special occasions when I lost count of how many drinks I've had. Next thing I knew, I was in the bed in a white room. My right leg was in a splint and my head felt as if it was about to come off. I was in a hospital and my leg was broken. A gal I knew called Dago was standing by the side of the bed. I couldn't believe it when she told me that I kept trying to get into the brawl the night before. You kept running in the middle of all those punches and someone kept pushing you back out, but that didn't stop you. You got right back in the middle of it again, and you got pushed out again, but this time you fell down a flight of stairs. She told me I'd been giving quite a time to the doctor who tried to set my leg. He'd just come from a party and was feeling no pain himself. We must have been quite the pair. I rolled and turned so violently that I broke three splints. He hadn't been too drunk to do his job, though. My leg healed in a normal length of time and never gave me a bit of trouble. I never told my mama what really happened, just in case she happened to hear something through the grapevine. I wrote and said that I'd sprained my ankle.
Raising a lion's den, and my nightly occupation is stealing other women's men.
Ada Bricktop Smith, she was a singer and dancer with the Patricia Orchestra, and another one is Jelly Roll Morton. He's probably the most famous guy who played there.
Jelly Roll Morton played the piano for me.
Used to bill himself as the originator of jazz. Both of their descriptions of the Patricia in Vancouver at the time was that, yeah, the audiences didn't really get it.
James Dandifer is a Vancouver-based composer and jazz clarinetist.
What? I'm from here. I've been playing Jelly Roll Morton's music, and I didn't know that he lived in Vancouver and that he worked at Pat's Pub, which is, you know, obviously still standing.
There was this idea, I guess like a slippery slope kind of tendency in terms of morality, where you starts out with going into a place for, you know, drinking a little beverage, and then music comes on, and then especially with like this crazy jazz music, it's like becomes a little bit sexual maybe.
Jazz originally was jazz, J-A-S-S, which was slang for sex. That kind of keys you into what this music meant at the time. It was really passionate, exciting, and sexy.
It was the leading edge of music at the time, and people responded to it in the same way that people responded to rock and punk now. And it had its fans, and it had its people who didn't like it.
Ain't nobody dead. Somebody must be dead drunk. Don't tell me. I think it's a funeral. Now look here. People, I do hear a funeral. People hear that trombone phone.
The greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange and market prices.
Provide health care for every man, woman,
how far would you go with that? How far?